Arizona is a public service of Rio Salado College. For more information, visit sunsounds.org.
It's 1 o'clock. It's time now for the reading of the Sunday, August 4th issue of the Sunday Arizona Republic. Our readers this afternoon are Bob Murphy and Fernando Cota.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Bob.
Good afternoon. My name is Fernando.
And we are going to read the Sunday Arizona Republic, and we're going to begin in Section A, page 1, with this headline, Texas Tragedy. Mass shooting in El Paso. This article is written by Cedar Atancio and Diana Hodgood of the Associated Press. El Paso, Texas. 20 people were killed and more than 24 injured in a shooting Saturday in a busy shopping area in the Texas border town of El Paso, the state's governor said. Among the possibilities being investigated is whether it was a hate crime, the police chief said. Two law enforcement officials who spoke to the Associated Press on condition of anonymity identified the suspect taken into custody as Patrick Cruces, 21. El Paso police haven't released his name, but confirmed the gunman is from Allen, near Dallas. Police said another 26 people were injured, and most were being treated at hospitals. Most of the victims were believed to have been shot at a Walmart near the Cielo Vista Mall, they said, adding that the store was packed with as many as 3,000 people during the busy back-to-school shopping season. The scene was a horrific one, said El Paso Police Chief Greg Allen, who described many of those hurt as having life-threatening injuries. He also said police found a post online that may have been written by the suspect. One reason authorities are looking at whether it was a hate crime. El Paso, which has about 680,000 residents, is in West Texas and sits across the border from Juarez, Mexico. Residents were quick to volunteer to give blood to the injured after the shooting, and police and military members were helping people look for missing loved ones. It's chaos right now, said Austin Johnson, an Army medic at nearby Fort Bliss, who volunteered to help at the shopping center and later at a school serving as a reunification center. Adriana Caseda, 39, said she was in the women's clothing section of Walmart with her two children when she heard shots. But I thought they were hits, like roof construction, she said. Her 19-year-old daughter and 16-year-old son threw themselves to the ground, then ran out of the store through an emergency exit. They were not hurt, Caseda said. She said she saw four men dressed in black moving together, firing guns indiscriminately. Police later said they believed the suspect was the sole shooter, but were continuing to investigate reports that others were involved. El Paso Police Sergeant Robert Gomez said the suspect, who used a rifle, was arrested without incident. The shooting came less than a week after a gunman opened fire on a California food festival. Santino William Ligon, 19, killed 3 people and injured 13 others late Sunday at the popular Gilroy Garlic Festival and died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Ryan Milkey, a spokesman for University Medical Center of El Paso, said 13 people were brought to the hospital with injuries after the Texas shooting, including one who died. Two of the injured were children were being transferred to El Paso Children's Hospital, he said. He wouldn't provide additional details on the victims. 11 other victims were being treated at Del Sol Medical Center, hospital spokesman Victor Guerrero said. Those victims' ages ranged from 35 to 82, he said. Governor Greg Abbott, who confirmed the number of victims at a news conference, called the shooting a heinous and senseless act of violence and said the state had deployed a number of law enforcement officers to the city. President Donald Trump tweeted, "Reports are very bad, many killed." Presidential candidate and former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke appeared a bit shaken as he appeared at a candidate forum Saturday in Las Vegas, shortly after news of the shooting in his hometown was reported. The Democrats said the shooting shatters any illusion that we have that progress is inevitable on tackling gun violence. He said he heard early reports that the shooter might have had a military-style weapon, saying we need to keep that, and he used an expletive, on the battlefield. Do not bring it into our communities. We have to find some reason for optimism and hope, or else we consign ourselves to a future where nearly 40,000 people a year will lose their lives to gun violence, and I cannot accept that, O'Rourke said. El Paso has become a focal point of the immigration debate, drawing Trump in February to argue that walling off the southern border would make the U.S. safer, while city residents in O'Rourke led thousands on a protest march past the barrier of barbed wire-topped fencing and towering metal slats. O'Rourke stressed that border walls haven't made his hometown safer. The city's murder rate was less than half the national average in 2005, the year before the start of its border fence. Before the wall project started, El Paso had been rated one of the three safest major U.S. cities going back to 1997. Heidi Byrick, director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, also said the El Paso shooting suspect wasn't on her group's radar screen prior to the shooting. "We had nothing in our files on him," Byrick wrote in an email.
Rural Arizona schools feel declining enrollment squeeze. This article is by Lily Altavina of the Arizona Republic. Arizona's rural schools sit along dirt roads. They appear like a mirage on the side of empty stretches of two-lane interstates. They are 100-year-old landmarks in small mining towns. The schools, specks on the map, are monuments to Arizona's history. Inside sits Arizona's future. But in most of Arizona's rural counties, the public school systems are increasingly strained. The education funding crisis in Arizona schools, highlighted by last year's hashtag RedForEd teacher protest, is compounded in rural schools. 10 Arizona counties, encompassing many of the state's rural areas, have together lost more than 10,000 students in the past decade, while Maricopa County resident student population has risen by more than 70,000. Fewer students means less money for schools, limiting students' educational opportunities, and making it more difficult to recruit and pay qualified teachers. And unlike in suburban districts, rural communities can't easily offset state funding losses with local taxes. The effects are crushing. School closures can leave families driving long distances or reliant on more controversial online school programs. Without enough qualified teachers, administrators are turning to long-term substitutes. Rural students in Arizona graduate at lower rates than rural students in other states. They don't perform as well on state testing as urban Arizona students. And the problems represent a cycle for rural Arizona communities, said Sean Rickert, with the Arizona Rural Schools Association and superintendent of Pima Unified School District in southeastern Arizona. The graduates are leaving and are not coming back because they don't see economic opportunities. Without the jobs, families don't stay and school populations decline. Without goods schools creating an educated workforce, jobs don't come. The main road to Crown King from Interstate 17 is not paved. Some sections are so narrow that just one car can fit. These are rocky cliffs and hills covered with prickly pear, the epitome of a desert landscape. And then drivers reach a short bridge into town deemed the Magic Bridge, where jagged rocks yield to pine trees and a stream trickles underneath the one-lane crossing. The town is a series of hills and small houses. In the middle sits an Old West saloon and Crown King Elementary, one of the state's last one-room schoolhouses. The Fire Engine Red School building turned 100 a few years ago. The district has one student, Logan Nelson, and one teacher, Shannon Olson. Enrollment at Crown King fluctuates every year. The school year began with 7 students, but a tragic car accident forced one family to move away. Another family left mid-year. Logan, the only student left, is a third-generation Crown King Elementary student. Her father and grandfather both attended the school. She's not lonely. The 11-year-old gets the kind of one-on-one attention from her teacher that parents yearn for. In the morning, they sit on a shaggy rug and talk about history. During the math lesson, they hunch over Olson's desk and work problem by problem on box plots. Logan and Olson eat lunch together and laugh over Garfield cartoons. Logan runs around Crown King's small playground unencumbered. Sometimes Olson runs too. "Honestly, it's a blessing," said Danielle Nelson, Logan's mom. "She's thriving." "The school is imperative for the community," Olson says. Logan's parents both work at the fire department, essential for an area vulnerable to wildfire. While the student population is unpredictable, there have always been students to serve. The next closest school in Mayer is more than an hour away on a rough road, difficult for a school bus to navigate, and sometimes near impossible for regular cars to drive without or during inclement weather. "There's really not another option," Olson says. "Online school exists, but internet in Crown King isn't always reliable either. For that reason, Logan took state testing on paper this year, not electronically like most Arizona students. Crown King's seesawing enrollment is unique. It's hard to track how the student population has changed because the school has long enrolled just a handful of students. But Crown King's County, Yavapai, has lost more than 2,300 students in the past decade. Rural population growth in America has lagged behind suburban and urban expansion for years. The student population in Arizona has increasingly clustered in Maricopa County. Since 2000, Maricopa County's K-12 public district and charter student enrollment has gone from 481,934 students to 737,280. The county has gone from having nearly 60% of the state's students to 66%. Other counties over the same two decades have experienced either less student growth or decline. About 150 of the 230 public schools designated rural by the state have lost students since the 2011-12 school year. Many of the schools considered rural that gained enrollment are charter schools, which have proliferated in the past decade in Arizona. While Maricopa County boasts the lion's share of the state's charter schools, some have sprung up in more populated towns like Flagstaff and Prescott. Rural charter school enrollment has somewhat increased, but it does not make up for enrollment lost at district schools. Tiny towns aren't alone in losing students. More popular rural communities are losing them, too. Sedona might be swarming with tourists, but it's not swarming with students. Sedona Oak Creek Unified School District has lost more than 300 students in the past 7 years. The district's enrollment dipped below 1,000 students in the past 2 years, and that downturn has come with repercussions. In 2018, the school board voted to close Big Park Community School, an elementary school in the village of Oak Creek, a suburb just south of the town's main stretch. "It was painful for community members," school board member Randy Howley said, "but the board had little choice. Declining enrollment coupled with chronic funding issues was the school's death knell. We've been underfunded from the state for 11 years. With declining enrollment, it makes it difficult to maintain small and elementary schools. It's been a very difficult year for all of us." "It's getting more expensive to live in Sedona," Howley said. "The median home value is $513,800. Short-term rentals have boomed, but long-term rentals are hard to come by, resulting in a housing shortage. The shortage has created two problems: Teachers can't afford to live in Sedona, so long commutes to more affordable areas hamper the district's ability to recruit and retain teachers, and young families can't easily afford to live in Sedona, causing enrollment to decline. Big Park's closure and affordable housing issues have been particularly difficult for Thea Sanderson-Jones, the parent of a 10-year-old with autism. She works in Sedona but lives in Cottonwood, about 30 minutes away. Her boyfriend recently started working in Flagstaff, an hour away from Cottonwood. They would like to live in Sedona or Oak Creek to cut down on commutes, but they can't afford to. Oak Creek would have been more affordable, but now its only elementary school is gone. Her son's school in Cottonwood is disappointing, she said. The district recently changed school boundaries, and he was suddenly sent to a different school. I just don't feel like he's getting the best education. Arizona's rural schools are not performing as well as their national peers. A 2017 report, Why Rural Matters, from the Rural School and Communities Trust, ranked Arizona as one of the worst states for rural school graduation rates and performance on national standardized tests. Nationally, the report calculated the average graduation rate for rural students as 87.3%, while Arizona was 77.5%. The rate for the state's rural students of color was even lower at 53.2% compared to 77.4% nationally. Maricopa County's third graders had the highest average third grade reading scores in 2018 on the state's standardized test, with 46% of third graders scoring proficient or highly proficient on the assessment. In seven rural counties, fewer than 40% of the third graders passed the reading tests. In Gila County, just 27% had proficient or highly proficient reading scores. Third grade reading is critical because that's when experts say students need to start reading to learn instead of learning to read. Arizona's school funding formula is calculated per student based on a complicated formula that accounts for, among other needs, whether a student needs special education services. With fewer students, school districts get fewer dollars. Those cuts are on top of cuts lawmakers made to school funding during the recession that still linger today. When adjusted for inflation, schools statewide are still getting less money per student than in 2009. Rural school leaders like Rickert and Holly say those recession-era cuts hit rural districts especially hard. Suburban districts can be somewhat counteract cuts with local taxes, but require voter approval. But that's harder for rural districts where the tax base is usually much smaller than a suburban district like Mesa, which has tens of thousands of taxpayers. Data from Portela, the school board's association, shows that districts outside of Maricopa County are less likely to seek local tax funding through voter-approved bonds and overrides, and measures in those counties are also less likely to pass. Sierra Vista Unified School District in southern Arizona unsuccessfully tried passing a $2.8 million maintenance and operations override in 2010. Holly Sheriff, a Sierra Vista school board member and parent, said going without override funding means her district has a harder time attracting teachers with a competitive salary and benefits. Most larger school districts in the Phoenix area and the Tucson area, they have override funding, so they have like up to 15% more funding per pupil than we have. The district did recently pass a $29 million bond for the new buildings, and voters passed a bond since 1991, according to the Herald Review, a local news outlet. The bond only helps capital needs. Sierra Vista can't use the money for teacher salaries or lowering class sizes. School funding woes ripple through a community when students aren't getting the kind of education that will turn them into skilled workers. It's just that much harder to recruit and retain qualified people to work in our hospitals and our businesses, she says.
Sun Sounds of Arizona time is 1:19, and our next article is titled AZ Officials Speak Out on El Paso Shooting by Serena O'Sullivan of the Arizona Republic. Members of the Arizona delegation voiced their thoughts on Twitter after a gunman opened fire on Saturday at an El Paso Walmart, killing at least 20 people and wounding dozens more. But one person had a more personal stake in the issue. Former U.S. Rep. Gabrielle Giffords was injured in a 2011 shooting outside Tucson that left 6 people dead and 13 wounded. She survived a gunshot to her head. Since then, she's been a tireless gun control activist, working with her husband and U.S. Senate candidate Mark Kelly to spread awareness and promote gun control legislation. She also spearheaded multiple coalitions to curb gun violence in America. In El Paso or anywhere else, our families should not be afraid to run errands. We should not be afraid to attend festivals or concerts. We should not be afraid to worship or go to school. But that's not the America we're living in today, Gifford said in a 2:37 p.m. Twitter thread. The time for action is now, she said. Most of Arizona's delegates didn't offer much in the way of action, however. U.S. Senator Martha McSally offered sympathy for the people who were involved in the mass shootings fallout, saying she was praying for first responders and those who were involved. Arizona's other senator did not comment on the act of domestic terrorism as of 5 p.m. on Saturday. The Arizona Republic contacted Kristen Sinema's office to ask for a statement, but so far there had been no response. Governor Doug Ducey's response was similar to McSally's. Our hearts are with everyone in El Paso, sending prayers for everyone involved, in gratitude for all the first responders and officers on the scene, he tweeted at 12:36 p.m. United States Representative Andy Biggs offered prayers as well. Another representative offered condolences but dropped the thoughts and prayers refrain. My heart breaks for the El Paso community, U.S. Representative Ann Kirkpatrick said at 2:40 p.m., Southern Arizona is with you. State Representative Daniel Hernandez Jr. didn't offer his thoughts or prayers. Instead, he gave encouragement to take action through joining or helping different gun control movements, such as Moms Demand Action or Gifford's organization. Hernandez recommended young people follow a local chapter of March for Our Lives. Gun violence is preventable, but only if we listen, only if we as citizens stand up against the well-funded Washington gun lobby, he said. State Representative Rosanna Gabaldon was on a similar page. The community should always feel safe at public places, and parents should never have to worry if their child will come home. I will fight for common sense gun reform that puts our schools, churches, and communities safety first, she said on Twitter. State Representative Diego Rodriguez added his opinion to the discussion, calling silence complicity. The hatred and ignorance that 45 pushes out to his racist base is empowering and encouraging domestic white terrorists, he said. Politicians weren't the only well-known Arizonans speaking out on the El Paso killings. ABC analyst and The View co-host Meghan McCain described the mass shooting as incomprehensible. The shooting investigation is ongoing, El Paso police said.
Here are Arizona's top agency heads and their salaries. This article is by Maria Porletta and Kyra Haas of the Arizona Republic. Greg McKay's recent decision to step down as State Department of Child Safety Director marks the latest in a string of state leadership changes during Governor Doug Ducey's five-year tenure. Since his initial round of appointments made when the Republican leader took office in 2015, Ducey has tapped more than 10 new agency directors to lead state agencies. The appointments have followed retirements, scandals, and restructuring, as well as department heads leaving to pursue other opportunities. Salaries for directors of 25 of the state's more high-profile agencies, a group that is overwhelmingly white and male, range from nearly $100,000 to more than $215,000, according to the most recent data available. That puts their earnings above Ducey's annual $95,000 salary, which is also among the lowest for U.S. governors. The state has several other boards, commissions, and offices that handle everything from accounting issues to services for Arizonans who are deaf and hard of hearing. Many directors in that group make between $60,000 and $99,000 a year, with several salaries topping six figures. A few agency heads are holdovers from previous administrations, such as Corrections Director Charles Ryan, but Ducey was involved in selecting most of them. The governor hosts in-person meetings with his cabinet quarterly, and Ducey staffers regularly communicate with department representatives. Here's a closer look at leaders of key departments, from how long they've been around and how much they make, to about how they've made the headlines. In administration, their purpose is to support state government operations by handling employee health benefits, worker compensation claims, facility maintenance, supply purchases, and IT needs, among others. The number of employees is 462. The director is Andy Tobin. He was appointed in 2019, and he replaced Craig Brown. His salary is $195,000 a year. Noteworthy, Tobin, a well-known figure in Arizona politics, was a Republican state legislator for years, serving as Speaker of the House from 2011 to 2014. He most recently served in the Arizona Corporation Commission. The Arizona Attorney General's office found that he broke the law in using that office to advocate against Proposition 127, a clean energy ballot initiative strongly opposed by Arizona Public Service. He was fined $225. The Department of Agriculture. Purpose: promote Arizona farming, ranching, and agribusiness, protect people, plants, animals, and the environment, safeguards commerce, and encourage consumer awareness. The number of employees is 263. Its director is Mark Killian. He was appointed in 2015, where he replaced Donald Butler. His salary is $132,000 a year. Noteworthy, 5 months after Ducey tapped him to lead the Agriculture Department, Killian resigned from the Arizona Board of Regents, which oversees the three state universities and hires university presidents. Killian said he stepped down because he just couldn't do both jobs justice. At the time of Killian's appointment, some had questioned whether he could maintain impartiality on the board while working in Ducey's administration. Arizona Health Care Cost Containment System, or ACCESS. Its purpose is to provide health coverage for low-income Arizonans. Number of employees, 1,089. Director Jamie Snyder, she was appointed 2019, replaced Tom Betlatch. Salary, $198,000 a year. Child safety, its purpose, responds to child neglect and abuse cases, licenses, foster care, agencies, and overseas adoptions. Number of employees in child safety, 2,745. Director Gregory McKay, appointed 2015, replaced Charles Flanagan, salary $215,250. Noteworthy, departing Director McKay, a former Phoenix police officer who investigated the fatal child abuse case of Amy Deal, was one of Ducey's earliest appointees. In his farewell letter to the agency staff, he credited DCS employees with transforming it from an agency with seemingly insurmountable problems and to one that won praise for the fastest reduction in foster care ranks while keeping kids safe. Casey Family Programs recognized that accomplishment last year with a national award. But he also had critics as well as legal challenges that will linger beyond his tenure. The state is still enmeshed in a long-running class action lawsuit that seeks changes in what critics call a dismal foster care system that leaves children without needed medical and behavioral services. Corrections. Purpose: operates state prisons, contracts with private prison operators. Number of employees, 8,877. Director, Charles Ryan, appointed 2009. Replaced, Dora Shiroo. Salary, $185,000. Noteworthy, Democratic lawmakers demanded Ryan's removal in April, the same day the Arizona Republic reported on understaffed prisons and underpaid corrections officers, and a few days after ABC 15 confirmed Ryan was unaware of broken locks on cell doors at Lewis Prison. The lock problems resulted in attacks on both inmates and officers and at least one death. Economic security. Purpose: provide temporary assistance for Arizona's in needs through programs such as Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, coordinates care for vulnerable residents such as those with developmental disabilities. Number of employees, 7,587. Director, Michael Traylor, appointed 2017. Replaced Tim Jeffries. Salary, $215,250. Noteworthy, Ducey appointed Traylor after the former director, Tim Jeffries, was forced to resign. The governor's decision followed Republic reporters that detailed questionable mass firings, as well as a DES party in Nogales, where Jeffries paid for alcohol for employees. Traylor spent nearly a decade overseeing the state housing department, including programs designed to help homeowners recover from the Great Recession. Emergency and military affairs. Purpose consists of the Arizona National Guard, the Division of Emergency Management, and the Division of Administration Services. Assist with emergency preparedness and recovery efforts. Number of employees, 453. Director, Michael McGuire, appointed 2013. Replaced, Hugo Salazar. Salary, $146,000. Noteworthy, McGuire began leading the department after National Guard Bureau investigators verified Arizona Republic reports of pervasive misconduct and mismanagement under Salazar. 3 years later, the Arizona National Guard suspended 9 top finance officials amid an investigation of accounting irregularities and potential wrongdoing related to multi-million dollar funds. At the time, McGuire said personnel actions were necessary in any organization and that efforts involving public funds demanded extra scrutiny. Environmental quality. Purpose, administer state environment laws and federal programs to prevent air, water, and land pollution and ensure appropriate cleanup. Number of employees, 425. Director, Misael Cabrera, appointed 2015, replaced Henry Darwin. Salary, $175,000. Forestry and fire management. Purpose, prevent and suppress fires, promote fire forest health, and encourage forest restoration effort. Number of employees, 131. Director David Tenney, appointed 2019, replaced Jeffrey Whitney, salary $140,000. Game and fish. Purpose, establish policies for wildlife preservation and harvest, ensure safe recreational opportunities, make rules and regulations for watercraft and off-highway vehicle operations. Number of employees, 593. Director Ty Gray, appointed 2017, replaces Larry Voiles. Salary, $160,000. Gaming. Purpose, regulates tribal gaming, racing and wagering, and boxing and mixed martial arts. Runs the Division of Problem Gambling, which offers treatment for gambling issues. Number of employees, 99. Director Ted Voigt, appointed 2019. Replaced Daniel Bergen. Salary, $135,000. Noteworthy. Voigt has held several prominent state government roles, such as director of Arizona Department of Veterans Affairs. He resigned as executive director of the Arizona Corporation Commission last year after concerns about a conflict of interest with APS. Health services. Purpose, administer health, mental health disease control, environmental health, and family health services. Number of employees, 1,403. Director Kara Christ, appointed 2015. Replaced Will Humble. Salary, $205,005. Noteworthy, Chris's department intervened after an incapacitated patient was raped and gave birth at a private Hacienda healthcare facility late last year. The agency took over regulation of the site to prevent it from closing. Homeland Security. Purpose, protects the state by preventing terrorist attacks in Arizona, enhancing border security, and heightening cybersecurity efforts, among other strategies. Employees, 12. Director Gilbert Arantia, appointed 2009, replaced Lessa Burns Morrison. Salary, $136,000. Housing. Purpose, manages funding for housing programs through the for-profit and non-profit developers, faith-based organizations, service organizations, and state, county, and city entities who apply for funding and meet criteria developed by state and federal laws. Number of employees, 69. Director Carol Ditmore, appointed 2017, replaced Michael Traylor. Salary, $141,750. Insurance and financial institutions. Purpose, promotes competitive but safe insurance marketplace. Licenses and oversees state-chartered financial institutions. Investigates consumer complaints. Number of employees, 125. Director, Keith Schreid. Appointed 2018, salary $132,000. Juvenile corrections. Purpose, supervises, rehabilitates, treats, and educates delinquent youth. Number of employees, 389. Director Jeffrey Hood. Appointed 2018, replaces Donna Mary Markley. Salary $155,000. Land. What it does, manages state trust land. Number of employees, 94. Director, Lisa Atkins. Appointed 2015. Replaced Vanessa Hickman. And salary, $175,000. Liquor licenses and control. Issues, transfers, renews, and audits liquor licenses. Investigates and processes complaints. Cooperates with law enforcement agencies. Researches and responds to inquiries from manufacturers, wholesalers, and retailers. Number of employees, 34. Director, John Coca. Appointed 2015. Replaced Alan Everett. Salary, $110,000. Lottery Commission. Purpose, develops and markets games that produce the maximum amount of net revenue for the state through responsible play. Number of employees is 90. Director, Gregory Edgar. Appointed 2016. Replaced Tony Bowie. His salary is $130,000. Parks. Purpose, maintain state parks and trails. Manages camping reservations. Number of employees is 179. Director is Robert Broschleid. Appointed in 2019. Replaces Sue Black. A salary of $170,000. Public safety. Primarily patrols and enforces state laws on Arizona highways. 1,974 employees. Director is Frank Milstead, who was appointed in 2015 and replaced Robert Halliday. The salary is $197,000. School Facilities Board manages state funding appropriated for K-12 school district facilities, including for instruction, construction, and repairs. 12 employees. Director is Paul Bacalis, appointed in 2016. He replaced Dean Gray with a salary of $140,000. Transportation. Plans, builds, and operates highway systems, builds and maintains bridges, provides title registration and driver license services through Motor Vehicle Division. Number of employees, 3,560. Director is John Alikowski. He was appointed in 2009 and replaced Victor Mendez. Salary is $150,000. Veteran Services helps veterans access federal benefits, runs veteran homes facilities in Phoenix and Tucson, and operates veteran cemeteries. Number of employees, 363. Director is Wanda Wright. Appointed in 2015, replaced Ted Voigt. Salary, $133,000. And finally, Water Resources. Ensures long-term reliable water supply for the state. 139 employees. Director is Thomas Bujarski, who was appointed in 2015, replaced Michael Lacey, and the salary is $140,000.
Excessive heat warning issued for Phoenix area by Chelsea Curtis of the Arizona Republic. The National Weather Service has issued an excessive heat warning for the Phoenix area in western parts of Arizona through Monday evening. High temperatures are expected to regain a hold on the valley, with temperatures increasing to between 110 to 115 degrees in the afternoon, according to National Weather Service meteorologist Larry Hopper. Overnight temperatures are expected to be in the upper 80s to near 90 degrees until Monday night, he added. Make sure to drink water when you're thirsty, stay hydrated, wear appropriate clothing and sunscreen, advised Hopper. Take care of the elderly, take care of any pets or anyone vulnerable to heat-related illness. There are more than 10 emergency heat relief stations across the valley, according to Maricopa County's website, www.maricopa.gov/2461/cooling-stations-water-donation. The stations are open on days with excessive heat warnings and allow leashed pets, the website states. Monsoon storms were expected to pull back from the valley over the weekend. On Friday night, there were a few thunderstorms in areas north of Anthem, bringing wind gusts up to 35 miles per hour, and lightning could be seen across the skies north of Phoenix, Hopper said. Some rainfall was recorded northwest of New River and into Yavapai County, but the storms didn't reach the metro area. Less than 10% chance of thunderstorms is expected during the excessive heat warning, Hopper said.
DNA test leads to man's arrest and rape of teen. This article is written by Aubrey Carpenter of the Arizona Republic. A Phoenix man was arrested on suspicion of raping a 16-year-old girl after a DNA test, according to court records. Police arrested Johnny Uribe, who was 24 at the time of the incident, on Wednesday after the DNA test revealed he was involved in a rape that occurred on March 21, 2016 in Phoenix. The 16-year-old girl and her 15-year-old cousin attended a party at Uribe's home near 83rd Avenue and Thomas Road, where they were provided alcohol and smoked marijuana. Her cousin witnessed the victim drinking heavily and kissing Uribe before he carried her to the bedroom. According to court documents, Uribe told the teens he was 21 years old, and the teens told him both of their ages when they met at the party earlier. After about 20 minutes, Uribe came out of the bedroom and told the victim's cousin to go check in on her in the bathroom. The victim was found not responding properly and without pants or underwear on. Both teens caught a ride to Burger King, where the 15-year-old called police. The court document said the victim was so intoxicated she was not able to converse with the police officers and was taken to the hospital. The victim only recalled going to the party and taking shots. Her cousin told the victim about Uribe's carrying her to the bedroom, but she had no recollection of anything until she woke up in the hospital. Uribe denied having a party or knowing the victims, despite being friends with them on Facebook. He told an officer he would love to get a DNA sample taken to prove nothing happened, so police ran DNA tests on him and the victim. The DNA matched, but Uribe continued to deny the allegations. Uribe was booked into a Maricopa County jail on suspicion of sexual misconduct with a minor and contributing to the delinquency of a minor. His bail was set at $100,000. Preliminary hearing will be on August 12th.
Casa Grande police find two bodies 5 miles from each other. Molly Hudson, reporter for the Arizona Republic. Two bodies were found on Wednesday morning in Casa Grande at separate locations. No evidence connected the discoveries, Casa Grande police said. Around 6 a.m., police received a call reporting a body in or near a wash at Maricopa-Casa Grande Highway, said Thomas Anderson, spokesman for Casa Grande Police. Police found a man's body on the side of the road near Maricopa-Casa Grande Highway and Val Vista Boulevard, Casa Grande Police tweeted at 7:01 a.m. Then, about 6:45 a.m., police received a second report about a body near Pinal Avenue and Ghost Ranch Road, Anderson said. This time, police discovered what appeared to be a woman's body near trees, according to a 7:37 a.m. tweet from Casa Grande Police. The two bodies were found approximately 5 miles from each other, Anderson said. Neither has been identified, and there appears to be no evidence connecting the two discoveries, according to police. It is unknown if either of the people found were homeless. Currently, police don't suspect foul play, Anderson added, but Anderson said the deaths may be weather-related. The man was found in an area known for flooding and fast-moving water during rainstorms, which affected the area on Tuesday night, Anderson stated. The woman was found by a major roadway, and Anderson said he suspects heat may have been a factor.
Police: human remains found near golf course. This article is by Brianne J. Frank and Serena O'Sullivan of the Arizona Republic. Human remains were discovered on Friday evening in a pond on a Phoenix golf course. Officers responded to the area near 8000 West Arizona Grand Parkway after the remains were found about 7:20 p.m. on the muddy edge of the pond. The area is part of the Maricopa-Guadalupe Flood Control District, and it is adjacent to the Arizona Grand Golf Course. Investigators worked overnight and through Saturday afternoon on the case. The Phoenix Police Search and Recovery Dive Team helped with the sweep of the pond. Then a body was discovered in the deeper area of the water. The body has been moved, but it's not clear how long it was submerged, and an investigation is ongoing.
Now, the time is 1:44, Sun Sounds of Arizona time, that is, and we'll turn to the Valley and State section, and we have one article in here titled, Surviving a Shooting. What did the ensuing decades have in store for Phoenix officer hurt in the line of duty? This article is authored by Jessica Boehm of the Arizona Republic. And there's an editor's note. This story was reported through hours of interviews with retired Phoenix Police Lieutenant Manny Quinones after several months and corroborated with Arizona Republic and Phoenix Gazette archives. In part one that ran last Sunday, Phoenix Police Detective Manny Quinones is shot while trying to serve a search warrant on repeat drug offender Luis Cordova. The year is 1966. He arrives at Good Samaritan Hospital, where he is prepared for surgery. As Manny lay unconscious in the hospital, the damage from his wounds had already revealed itself at home. Manny's son, who went by Manny, was 7 when he heard a knock on the door before school. He stood beside his mother as she answered the door. He watched the shock spread across her face as two Phoenix police detectives told her that her husband had been shot. The boy understood what the officers meant, but not the gravity of the situation. He thought of the cop shows on TV. They got shot all the time and were always back for more adventures by the next week's episode. He didn't realize his father was critically wounded and would spend the next 3 weeks in the hospital. During that time, he and his sister Lisa would be escorted back and forth to Roosevelt Grammar School in a police car. His youngest brother, Louis, was only 2. An officer would guard their South Phoenix home day and night, and the hospital had mistakenly released Manny's home address to the media, and the police department was on high alert, fearing that friends of Cordova, who died at Good Samaritan shortly after the shooting, would come for Manny's family. "I'm glad the pig was shot. I hope he dies," a stranger's voice would tell young Manny one day when he picked up the phone. Their home phone number could be found easily in the phone book. It was one of several similar calls made to the Quinones home in the weeks following the shooting. Manny was discharged 3 weeks later and ordered to spend 2 months recovering at home. But it didn't keep him from working. Informants started calling his house 3 days after Manny arrived home from the hospital. They had tips on burglaries and robberies. He was still in bandages, but making calls. He'd end up thwarting a burglary and an armed robbery that week. He wanted to get back to work, but his body wasn't ready. Later, he realized his mind wasn't either. Manny couldn't stop thinking about the shooting, but he didn't want to talk about it. He became paranoid, avoiding the windows of his house and surveying his yard for intruders. Post-traumatic stress disorder was a condition he'd never heard of in 1966. The department didn't employ psychiatrists or counselors, or if they did, Manny didn't know about them. Today, he knows he was suffering. But then, he probably wouldn't have asked for help if it was available. It was a macho thing. He only knew of one coping mechanism, one way to keep the repetitive thoughts at bay. He found it in a bottle. The people of South Phoenix called the Phoenix Police Department the Black Gestapo, alluding to the Nazi Germany police force and the Phoenix officers' all-black uniforms. They were angry. They didn't want to be part of the city of Phoenix. Annexation meant more law enforcement, more taxes, and forced loyalty to a city hall that had not yet gained the trust of the low-income Latino neighborhoods. After the Phoenix City Council voted to annex 75 miles of what is now South and West Phoenix in 1960, a police officer hit and killed a teenager while driving his patrol car on a poorly lit street in South Phoenix, escalating tensions to an all-time high. Manny's duty as a patrol officer on the South Side at the time was as much about repairing broken relationships as it was about making arrests. His department issued vehicle didn't have air conditioning the first year he was assigned to South Phoenix. He kept his windows down to allow a breeze to trickle in, but it also allowed him to connect with the community in a way that many officers didn't know. They could see him, and he could see them. He'd wave as he drove by and talk to them in Spanish at stoplights. They began to trust him. Soon they were tipping him off to criminal activity in the area and calling the station to ask for Manny to come handle issues. The community accepted him. Not all of his colleagues received the same welcome. The El Rey Cafe was a 75-seat Mexican restaurant on Central Avenue near Buckeye Road. It was open late, making it a perfect after-duty hangout for officers. But on August 31, 1963, Manny was sent to the restaurant on official duty. His captain told him and his partner, Jesse Stokes, to go to the cafe in plain clothes, sit at the bar, and keep an eye out for any trouble. "Are you expecting a problem?" Manny asked. The captain said no. What he didn't tell Manny was there were rumblings that the civil rights movement that had been unfolding across the nation was about to hit Phoenix, specifically El Rey Cafe. Manny and Stokes sat at the bar and ordered a bowl of green chili. Doug Nelson, an African-American sergeant who would later lead the department's first community relations bureau, walked into El Rey Cafe and tried to give his order to the owner, Connie Peralta. "We don't serve ends here," Peralta told him. Nelson tried to order again. "You don't understand. We don't serve ends here," she said. Manny was taken aback. He didn't know that the cafe refused service to African Americans, but he quickly realized why he had been sent there on that day. Peralta's son, the cook, came out from the kitchen wielding a baseball bat. Manny and Stokes abruptly stood up and got between the Peraltas and Nelson. Manny looked through the front window of the cafe and saw 50 or 60 members of the NAACP picketing. Nelson, with the support of the police department's leadership, had been working with the NAACP to clamp down on racial discrimination throughout the city. The peaceful demonstrations continued for 8 days. Peralta eventually decided to change her policy and allow African-American customers, but only because she received anonymous threats, she told a Republic reporter. Manny watched as his city changed right in front of him. He didn't want to admit that he was changing too. After he'd physically recovered from being shot, Manny returned to the department as a narcotics detective on January 4, 1967. His partner, Stokes, had returned about a week earlier. They came back to work too soon, they would both later concede. They'd spend most of their days together, sometimes hours at a time on mundane surveillance assignments. They never talked about the shooting. Manny didn't talk to anyone about the shooting, not even his wife, but he thought about it constantly. Manny was never seen in a bar, but alcohol had control of his life. A six-pack of beer and a swig of whiskey eased the paranoia, the anxiety, the memories. He was a closet drinker, keeping his vice from everyone except the people who meant the most. Mary and the kids could see what was happening, but Manny wouldn't tell them why. He was promoted to sergeant and stationed in South Phoenix in April 1968. In August, a call came through about a disturbance in the Sydney P. Osborne housing projects. Manny pulled in through an alleyway as a shotgun blast blew out one of his officer's tires. Manny grabbed his shotgun and started walking toward where the shot was fired. Click, boom. Three birdshot pellets pierced the top of his head, his upper lip, and left arm. His wounds were minor, but he still dreaded telling his wife and mother that he'd been shot again. He drove himself to St. Luke's Hospital, where a doctor removed two of the pellets. The doctor couldn't get to the pellet in his lip because it was too swollen. It would eventually start to fester its way out through the inside of his lip, and Manny would pull it out himself. When he returned to work, he had transfer orders waiting for him. He was to be the relief sergeant, working mostly from the front desk and entirely off the streets. The higher-ups said the change was for the good of the department. Manny knew it was really for the good of his wife, who saw her husband hospitalized for gunshot wounds twice in less than 2 years. It would be 10 years before he returned to patrol. During that time, he'd serve as a narcotics sergeant, where he would be recognized by the American Legion as the Phoenix Police Officer of the Year and nominated for the White House Advisory Committee Conference on Children and Youth. He was excelling professionally, never letting his internal battle wounds show through while on the job. But Manny often relived the shooting in his mind, the first shooting, the one that almost left him dead, the one that did leave Cordova dead. He'd wake up in a puddle of sweat. He'd have another drink. Manny retired from the Phoenix Police Department in 1988 as an accomplished lieutenant. As he prepared to leave the career that had consumed most of his life, he couldn't help but realize he was leaving a very different department than the one he was hired onto 30 years earlier. The department had removed height and weight requirements for officers in the 1970s, which opened the door for more female recruits. Police Chief Larry Wetzel, who served in that role from 68 to 80, established a community relations division and had its leadership visit Southern universities to recruit African-American officers. Well, that brings us to the end of the first hour of the reading of the Sunday Arizona Republic. Fernando and I will return shortly.